Welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 35. Today on the show, I have Cameron Joss, Director of Sports Performance at DeFranco's Gym. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology.
All right, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here with us today. I'm your host, Joel Smith, and today on the show we have Cameron Joss. Cameron is one of the best and brightest young strength coaches in the industry today. He's 26 years old. I think he might just be the youngest coach we've had on the show. I think Matt Van Dyke might have been 27, 28. And Matt, I apologize if I forget how old you were, but Cameron is doing some awesome things. He's the director of sports performance at DeFranco's Gym in New Jersey. He's working with NFL athletes and pro day athletes, amongst others. And he himself trained under Joe for years as a scholastic athlete before eventually joining his staff. And he's doing some awesome work now. Some of the things we're going to talk about today, Center, it almost is like the fulfillment of some other things I've talked about with other guests on the show, such as JB Marin, because we're going to talk a lot about heavy sled training and how Cameron is practically using that heavy sled training now, using the 1080 Sprint to make that happen. But even if you don't have a 1080 Sprint, this is also something that you can do with heavy, regular, traditional sleds. But as you'll see through hearing Cameron talk about it, just the specificity that he's deriving out of the 1080, and you could use it, you can use a stopwatch as well as an alternative with a regular sled, but just the specificity he is using and some of the equations he's using in conjunction with some of these PhDs to get this work with the NFL guys, it's really amazing. And I think it's really spearheading this practical caseload of what we're going to see out of heavy sled and heavy resisted work for the purpose of building better acceleration, better force and acceleration. So that was just it was a really cool little conversation that we talked about early in the episode. As we move forward, we talked a little bit about this, things like Cameron's take on the speed ladder. Obviously, if you're an experienced physical preparation coach, most of us really kind of frown on the speed ladder as an actual means of training on-field agility. But Cameron has just a great take and viewpoint on the details on why that is, not just saying why it's, you know, saying generally it's not a good thing. Also, we're going to talk a little bit about vertical jump. We're going to talk about game speed training. So more than just building linear speed or being able to do like a 505 agility quickly, how do we actually take this speed and make it even more relevant for on-field performances? Cameron goes into detail on ability to react to defenses and react to situations and sensory and visual information. And that was an awesome talk. And it's just kind of almost makes you think about where the future of this physical preparation industry is headed. We're also going to talk about building the feet for athletic performance and how Cameron does that. We're going to talk about his vertical jump testing and training battery, which is just awesome. Overall, this was an amazing show to do. I really enjoyed talking to him on this one. You guys are going to love this episode. It's been one of my favorites to do so far. Let's get on to the show. All right, Cameron, welcome to the show today. It's great to have you on here, man.
Thanks for having me, man. I'm a big time fan of the podcast. I've been listening for a while and couldn't be more happy to be on. I appreciate you reaching out to me.
Well, it's great to have you here. Could you start it off by just chatting a little bit about your background in the field and where you got to where you are now?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm relatively young in the field, and I'm 26 years old right now. And it really all started for me where I was an athlete training with my boss, Joe DeFranco. He was actually training me for high school football. And then I trained with him while I was playing college football as well. And the whole time I fell in love with the concept of being able to transform guys and physically and get them to achieve new levels of physical output and all of that sort of stuff. And so much so that when I went to college, I decided I wanted to study kinesiology. So while I was in school, I was studying kinesiology and exercise science, got my bachelor's in that. And then during my senior year, after my last season of football, in the spring semester, I went and I did an internship at University of South Carolina, where I was with the strength and conditioning, where we worked with football, and they also worked a little bit with the track and field teams, the throwers, and then with men's soccer a little bit as well. So that was a cool experience. I learned a lot about how to manage a lot of athletes at once and how to keep a gym clean. They were very anal about keeping the gym clean. And the head coach there at the time is Joe Connolly. He's at University of Massachusetts now. And so I worked under him there. And then from there, I kind of entered a limbo state for a very short period of time. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was like, do I try to become a GA and work my way up in the collegiate field, or do I try to go back to the private sector? And it just came down to a phone call with Joe DeFranco. And I basically said to him, you know, I don't know what I want to do. You know, what's your advice? And he gave me this whole spiel about the positives and negatives of college sector and the private sector and all that. And then at the very end, he's just like, you know, well, I was thinking about bringing somebody else on if you're interested. And I was like, why didn't you just open with that? You know, like, yeah, I'm interested. Like, yeah, I need a job for sure. And, you know, you've been mentoring me throughout my entire when I was your client and then throughout college as well. So I was like, of course I want to come work with you. So I started up with him and really started working for him in New Jersey, the last facility that we had in New Jersey. And from there, I was low man on the totem pole. I had just started there and he threw me right to the fire. I had to learn about how to program on my own pretty much. I had to handle my athletes on my own. Like he really didn't hold my hand through any of it, which I thought was great. I had to adapt really quick. And then he came to me, he said, would you like to take this opportunity to go to Austin, Texas? I'm probably going to move my gym down there. And we're going to try this co-branding experiment with the company Onnit that sells, you know, supplements and a couple different nutritional products. And they have a whole fitness component to what they do as well. And so I went down to Austin, Texas for 2 years. I was down there. And around the second year, I reached back to Joe and I said, hey, like, I have some ideas about where I think we should head with the business. And, you know, he started doing all these different educational things and consulting and whatnot. And I said, why don't we try to combine those two? Let's kind of downsize the business a little bit, make the quality a little bit higher, and, you know, take lesser clients, but more attention given to them. So that was my idea and he was all for it. So we basically, we left Austin, Texas, moved back to New Jersey, and now we have our facility here and that's exactly what we're doing. And, you know, Joe does pretty much all the business related stuff and he's the face of the business and I'm basically director of sports performance and I work with all the athletes and it's awesome, man. I love what I'm doing right now.
Hey, that's awesome, man. What's the weather for sprinting, by the way, there in New Jersey right now?
The weather is, it's been holding up around 40 degrees, which is like, you know, not too cold and not too bad. But, you know, I tell the football guys and I know as well as anybody else that obviously the risk goes up when you're sprinting in the cold. But I really warm them up thoroughly and I make sure I tell them just mentally to get them to engage a little bit more. I'm like, you guys got to play football in the snow. You know, you never know what you're going to be in. So I was like, you can handle like a 40 degree temperature. You'll be all right. And we don't do like so much volume that it'll kill them anyway. So, but yeah, it snowed today. So we'll see how it holds up for the rest of the week. And I'm hoping we can get out there on Saturday morning, but we'll see.
Yeah. I remember when I was working at Wilmington College in Ohio, we didn't have an indoor track. And if it was 40, that was like prime go outside and sprint day in January. It was crazy.
We got the luxury that our facility is pretty small. It's only maybe, you know, between 1,000, 2,000 square feet of just weight room space. But right across the field, literally, you know, 10 steps from the front door of the gym, there's a whole turf football field with a track around it. So that's a nice blessing when the weather holds up. So it'll be great in the spring and the summer. Right now, we're seeing what we can get with it.
Got to be creative too sometimes. And so on the topic of sprinting too, I want to kick that off the next series of a few questions. Is how are you using the 1080 sprint in the sprint training for your athletes? And then I'll have a few follow-up questions after that.
Yeah, so right now I'm using it pretty much only with our guys that are either NFL vets or they're guys that are trying to train for their pro days. So what I'm doing right now is I have a group of guys, some of them that are veterans are just going to redo their pro day. So they're going to do it again at their college that they already did it once. They're going to do it again just for some more exposure. And so my goal is basically that I understand how important the 40-yard dash is for these guys. Like, it's pretty much the only test that matters, because the only time they talk about the other tests like vertical and the shuttle and all that is after they mention, oh, he ran this fast 40 and then he also did this. They never say like he ran slow, but then, oh, look, he jumped really, they don't talk about that at all. So like, I understand that the 40 is everything. So the guys that have already done it, I'm looking at what their numbers were last time they did it, and now I'm trying to improve upon those. And the guys that haven't done it yet, I'm hoping they come out with a bang. So I'm using the 1080 specifically with those guys for basically a little experiment that I'm trying to see, sort of applying the concepts of the research with, J.B. Morin, Sam Mazzino, Matt Cross, those type of guys. So that's what I'm doing right now is I looked at particularly the one study that Matt Cross was on with those guys and looking at the optimal load for maximal power output, specifically in the sprinting motion. And, it's pretty cool that the 1080 allows you to have all of this data available to you instantaneously. So, the study basically showed that people doing sled sprinting, they weren't doing it with enough weight to elicit enough of a power effect. So, the study basically concluded that anywhere from 69 to 91% of body mass should be on the sled. And that's for recreational or team sport athletes, and then as high as 96% of the body mass for actual real sprinters. So, and that's obviously to improve the mechanical capacity for force at lower velocities so that it can help with the acceleration component of the sprinting and producing force at greater velocities, because that's what's characterizing the better sprinters versus the less well-trained sprinters. And he basically, with that study, concluded that the optimal load is found within a range of 48 to 52% of the velocity decrement. So once they reach that 50% zone, approximately, of where their unloaded velocity max would be, that's probably around the load that their max power is going to be. So what I did basically is I took these guys on the 1080 and I tested 20 meter sprints, and I kept that just the constant distance the whole time. And I tested them against a complete wide range of different loads on the 1080. So the 1080 has different settings and they're all in kilograms. And so I tested them from 3 kilograms all the way up to 30 kilograms on the machine. And they also have a friction coefficient of around 35%, so 0.35. So if you take the numbers and divide it by 0.35, that's really the load they're feeling if they were to equate it to load just on like a typical sled, on turf. So it's actually heavier than people think when they see the numbers on the setting on the 1080. But, we can get into that a little bit later. But yeah, I tested them around all these different loads. And really what I did is that I sent the results to a guy by the name of Ola Eriksrud. I hope I'm pronouncing his last name the right way. I've only ever called him Ola. But he's basically an assistant professor of biomechanics, anatomy, and I think motor control at the Norwegian School of Sports Science, Sports Sciences. And he had all of the formulas that were published by J.B. Morin and Sam Mazzino and Matt Cross and these guys. What he did for me is he basically designed an entire force velocity profile for each of my athletes, which was amazing. I couldn't have done it on my own. There's no way. And he showed me the predicted maximal force, or as it's written there, the F0, and then the maximal velocity, or the V0. And it was cool because if you looked at the coefficient of determination, the R squared, if you will, all the guys were like a 0.98 or higher. And obviously the closer to 1.0, the more accurate the data is. So what he did is I took his prediction of the V0 there for each of my guys, and I found the load where they were at about 50% of that number. And I determined that to be their optimal load for what we're going to be doing in training. And, you know, it's the cool thing is that what he did for me can now be done with the My Sprint app. You know, it's if you film the sprints on that app, and they can actually give you, I think it's been verified, the data on there where you can actually get that number there too. You know, if you're someone that has access to the 1080, at which point you can then determine the load that's going to be used for this type of experiment. So, you know, it's pretty interesting when I looked it up, because when I finally found that load, you know, as an example, I had two different running backs. One of them was a little bit bigger. He's about 220 pounds. And his 50% max velocity fell around a load that was 74% of his body mass. So that was around the load that would have been quote unquote optimal for him. And then the other running back, who's only about 200 pounds, his load fell around 82% of his body mass. So, you know, much higher than typically people use in sprint training or with sleds, but it is within the range that Matt Cross is talking about. So I thought that was interesting that it did fall within the range that he talked about in his study. And so right now my goal is basically just to train these guys really for the next, we did all this testing the last 2 weeks. So I'm going to try to train these guys for the next 4 weeks against this optimal load. You know, we'll do maybe like 4 to 6 reps or something in the workout against their quote unquote optimal load. And then what I'll do is just drop them down and do a little bit of like a contrast set where I do some lighter reps on the 1080 against loads that will still maintain the kinematic structure of sprinting. So anywhere from like, you know, 7.5 or 15% of their velocity decrement. So much less resistance than what we're doing against the quote unquote optimal load. But I want to make sure that I preserve some of the sprinting motion in there. And if you go from as heavy as the optimal load is to completely unloaded, it's almost too much within the same time frame, because I tried it out of myself and I fell flat on my face coming out in the unloaded sprint. I felt ridiculously powerful coming out of my stance, but I fell flat on my face. I'm like, it's not going to work if I do that. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to start tapering them down with the lighter resistance after we do those sets against the optimal load. So that's kind of my goal for the next 4 weeks. And then from there, we'll probably transition into doing more unloaded work and just kind of see what happens leading into their pro days. And, you know, I'm excited to see what happens with it.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Yeah, I am too. And ever since JB Marin talked to me on earlier podcasts about some of the stuff that was happening at the research and the optimal load, and that it's okay to go heavier than that 10% speed decrement, that was really interesting to me. I like what you did there too, with like coming off of the heavy load, doing like a little bit of lighter stuff, like following up the high stimulus with that medium intensity and more technical stimulus. I've seen stuff like that in like Bondarchuk's theory and the throws and those methods. It's cool to see that tie in there as well. So with the heavy stuff that you're doing with those guys, and maybe this could be a question that could be, you know, for whether people have a 1080 or not, because obviously, I mean, 1080, mm-hmm. amazing piece of technology, but not everybody has one. How much are these guys getting slowed down relative to their maximal speed in these accelerations with some of these optimal loads that you're doing?
With the optimal load that I'm using, I found their 50% drop off point basically with that. But it's interesting because I was able to quantify against all these different loads how much they're dropping off as a percentage of their split times, which was interesting. So, you know, they could get to when I lighten them up, basically, because they're going as high as, some of them are going as high as 80% of their body mass. So it's obviously significantly slower than an unloaded sprint, you know, but that's 50% of their estimated unloaded max velocity. But against like some of the lighter resistances, like what I was talking about, where I'm trying to maintain the kinematic structure by doing some of those lighter loads, you know, they're anywhere from 85%+ of their unloaded split times and stuff like that. So some of the guys that are more forceful and able to produce more horizontal force, they can use higher loads and stay close to 90% of their unloaded split time. So it's pretty cool to see. And I'm curious to see how it develops over time too, to see like how much they can sort of stay closer to their 90% point against those lighter resistances but to see how heavy they can get and still stay close to that. So as their force abilities improve by training at the optimal load for max power, as predicted by, you know, the stuff that Cross was talking about. So I don't know. I'm curious to see what happens. And the cool thing is with the 1080 is obviously that it gives you all that data, but, you know, somebody that doesn't have access to it, it's still something that you can at least keep split times in, that it'll, at least it's not fully accurate, you know, to be perfectly honest, based on the stuff that they're doing, but it's still enough to understand and push you in the right direction of where what these guys are talking about, basically. So it's sort of like the whole thing about just getting it done however you can get it done, you know? So
yeah.
But I do think that if the 50% rule, it doesn't work with split time. I will say that, because if you look at the split times of these guys while they were a percentage of like their unloaded split time, even though if you look at the actual velocity data, it was 50%. It was higher than that for their like split time percentage. It might have been like 60 to 70% of their split time. So definitely keep that in mind, just based off what I saw given the report on the 1080. So split time, you know, it's not quite as accurate as trying to actually measure velocity, but it's still a step in the right direction.
Okay, so you're saying that the optimal load had them running about 60 to 70% as fast as they could, or a 30% decrement.
Yeah, if you only take split time, that's what I found. Yeah, if you're not actually measuring velocity as meters per second, but you're taking just the time it takes them to run 20 meters, I found it to be, you know, like higher than 60%. So, you know, I don't know. That's something that's obviously not published. That's just what I found. So
okay, that makes sense to me now. So the 50% is of the maximal velocity, but then there's also the split time, which that would be something more relevant if someone didn't have a 1080. If you're just working with a sled or something like that, and you're doing
right. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it makes good sense. And I just really like what you said before, Cameron, about the effect was so powerful, like that skill effect, that if you just went to unweighted, all of a sudden you'd fall on your face because the skill dynamics had changed. And that's something I've just been thinking about more and more. I know when I was a high jumper, if I would do like a focus on a three-step jump and then all of a sudden go to my full approach, I just couldn't take off. Like the just the way the human body kind of runs those skills in the short term. But obviously, this just seems like such a smart way to do it with the light and kind of progressing there. So I'm excited to see what results you get, definitely, and excited to stay updated in that regard.
Me too. I mean, it's interesting, you know, because you can, with jump work, you know, you can kind of get away with it. Like you could do a heavy squat and then follow it up with an unloaded jump and it's like, okay. But I think it's just because of how technical sprinting is, that's a big reason why, you know, JB Marin and those guys say that the heavy sled work is not technical work. It's theoretically strength work specific for sprinting. And I think that's important for people to understand that, because if you try to go that heavy and then go unloaded, you're going to fall on your face like I did. So, but that's why I wanted to keep some of the lighter resisted loads in there, so that we could still practice some technically similar motions in the same workout, but still get some quality work in doing that.
Yeah, that's cool. One question, I think I may have brought this up when I was talking to JB. I'm not sure to what extent, but basically the relationship between doing something like that, like it's strength, right? It's heavy and it's strength, and the relationship between that and what you're doing in the weight room. And is what you're doing out there like cutting down the volume of what you're doing in the weight room, or changing or redefining some of the things that you're doing in the weight room?
Yeah, a little bit, because I'm of the opinion, and it's really not even an opinion at this point, it's sort of just getting to the point where it's just common knowledge that, you know, all the loads are accumulating. So what I'm doing on the field, I need to take that in consideration when I go into the weight room. So I still do, you know, give them some basic strength work, but the volume will be on the low volume end of things. And it's more just to keep the exercise variation in with the workout. And I'm not trying to kill them with barbell work and stuff like that, but you know, we'll do it in the same workout, but definitely the volume will be minimized due to the stuff that we're doing with the 1080 and all the heavy sled loading. Because, you know, ask any of my athletes, after you do that, their legs are, they're definitely feeling it in their legs after working with that 1080 and just doing those sprint works. So, yeah, you definitely have to take that into consideration for sure.
Yeah, that's cool. I was actually just thinking as you were saying that the way the muscles are stimulated is obviously probably different than squatting too. With the acceleration, I imagine it's more concentric in nature. You almost don't have that eccentric load like you do when you squat, but it's still obviously very, very taxing in its own right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting, you know, because I'm so almost foreign to this type of stuff in a way, because I'm trying it out with these guys and just trying to get their feedback. And I do it on myself too, and I know how it feels. And I think it's just because the nature of what you're telling them to do when they're doing it, which is like run as fast as you possibly can against all this weight, it's the effort is there, and it's just, it's very taxing. It took them, you know, upwards of 5 seconds or 5 to 6 seconds to run 20 meters against this load. So, I mean, it's a lot of work to just get to 20 meters. So, you know, there's definitely like sort of an endurance component to it as well.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, when you're pressing that hard, especially, it reminds me a little bit of like the K-box too, where like it 5 or 6 seconds of work on that thing is tough too, because the muscles are always under such this intense loading compared to 5 or 6 seconds of something else, or even traditional weightlifting.
Yeah, I think it's just, and they're all used to doing the traditional weightlifting type of work, like squatting and lunges and, you know, whatever. But this is like totally new for them. They've never done this type of stuff before. So I think there's a familiarity component to it as well.
Yeah, that rate of ATP expenditure has got to be crazy. I imagine too, just the harnessing of the competitive energy that comes just from sprinting, something that's primal and innate and competitive sprinting. Whereas you may not get, I mean, you can obviously be using bar speed tools in the weight room, but I think that has a almost a mind of its own in some ways, and that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting because, you know, to your point with the velocity-based work, you know, you are doing, they are referring to this as strength work, but if you look at, like, the average velocity of the actual sprint against the optimal load, I mean, guys are hitting over 4 meters per second. I mean, you're not going to do that with any kind of weightlifting exercise, so... Yeah, it is interesting for sure.
Yeah, yeah, taking velocity-based training out to the track or the field of play in a sense.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
Yep, exactly.
Cool, man. Moving on a little bit in the world of speed, and that was awesome stuff. That was just great information. But what's your take on the role of movement skill in sport speed versus just straight linear speed or track speed? So how do you approach speed in the context of football for some of these guys, and like vision and reaction and sensory input versus just sprinting?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's something that I'm pretty passionate about right now as well. And obviously with these guys that I was just talking about, they're training for a pro day right now. So a lot of the emphasis is on the 40-yard dash. So we are doing a lot of just linear sprint-based work. But if they weren't having their pro days and they were just NFL athletes that were currently on rosters and just in the off season, I would make sure to put an emphasis on like the sensory motor components that are going to be found in their sport. And that's something that I think people sort of ignore, because it's hard. You know, it's not easy to get creative with that type of stuff. And the guy who finally convinced me that it's important is Sean Mishka, who's like, if you can find him on social media, is like Movement Miyagi or whatever, and he's got like his optimizedmovement.com and all, but he's super passionate about it, like to the extreme, and I love the guy because he's got so much energy. But he was the guy that really made it kind of click in my head that the reactive components of a team sport, there's something there. Like, it's not enough to just get someone to sprint fast without any sort of reaction. And my realization came when I was doing a workout with a guy one day, and we were doing 10-yard sprints as part of the workout. And I had my timer out there. We were measuring our times and all that. And at one point he turned around and he said to me, how about you step behind me, like one step back and one step to the right, and then as soon as I move, try to catch me. And I was beating him on the sprints. Like if you looked at the times, I was killing him on the sprints, like, not to brag, but I'm just saying, you know, I was beating him. But then when I had to catch him, I couldn't catch him. And I hadn't played football in years since college. And then we flip-flopped, and I became the guy that he was chasing, and he caught me every time. So even though I was faster than him with just doing basic linear sprinting with no reactive component, he was faster in the context of reacting to me and me reacting to him. So that's sort of where I remember I called Sean Mishka, and I was like, dude, I get it now. You know, it makes sense to me now. What you're saying is that you have to, the same way that you would, that like somebody like JB Marin would say, you have to improve the force output of sprinting, but then apply it to the context of the efficiency of sprinting. The same thing is when you take a step further now and say, now I have the force output, I'm efficient at sprinting, but now can I be efficient at reacting to somebody and maintain my mechanics of running or whatever, you know? And that's what Sean talks about, is really you have your gross motor skills versus like your fine, like really just complex motor skills that are found in sports. And so I think that's the stuff that really is like the true movement skill in developing speed for team sports, or the quote unquote vision, quote unquote reactive ability. And, you know, it's crazy when you break it down to a biomechanical level, or as Sean talks about, the biodynamic level, where you're looking at the movements and the forces and all that stuff, because you start to see just how much guys that are pro athletes that are on rosters that are starting are compensators. And they're like the world's greatest compensators because their gross motor abilities are so good, because they're so fast or whatever, they can compensate. But when you really look at them on film, their movement sucks. And it's crazy to think that there's guys starting like in the NFL that can't move that well, but they're just, and coaches don't really even think about it, because they're like, well, he's getting from point A to point B really well. But, and then they wonder why guys are getting non-contact injuries, things like that. And it all kind of ties into it, because you have to be prepped for everything. And you know, it's the concept of you're either prepared for something or you're not. So if you take the sport and look at it as it really is, it's like there's a lot of reactive components to a sport like American football. And if you're not prepped for that, then that part of the game is gonna be tough for you, because you're not ready for it. So it took a long time for me to accept that. You know, that was something that was really hard for me to grasp, because it was, like I said, it was difficult, like compared to stuff that's more measurable, you know, like strength is measurable, speed is measurable, power is as well. This stuff's not measurable. It's just, it is or it isn't. Like, you either make the play or you don't. So that's why I'm such a nerd with tracking the data of things, and there's no data with this stuff, and that's just the way it is. And it's, you know, that's hard for people to grasp, I think, but I finally accepted it as a necessary evil, and I'm really glad that I did. And, you know, it's something now that I've started like really recently trying to apply it into my programming. And, you know, it's something that it starts with stuff as easy as the sort of like that, I call them cat and mouse drills, where you have one guy's the runner, one guy's the chaser, but then you can get even more specific to where now you're adding elements of the actual sport. You know, are you getting these guys to understand how to move in the face of opponents and how to react to them, how to get out of the way? Or if they're, you know, a defender in a sport like football, can they pursue somebody properly with the right angle and know how to decelerate in the face of them trying to react to their opponent? And so really what it comes down to when you're training for that stuff is, and it's sort of a buzzword right now, but the constraints-led approach to things is, what are the constraints that are found within the game, and how can I alter those in training to basically get these guys more prepared for what's going on? And it could be something as simple as the starting position that they're in. You know, you have a guy face to the side, another guy is facing straight ahead, and they come at each other, and one guy has to tag the other one has to get around the other guy. That's just a rudimentary example, but you know, it's just stuff like that. And obviously with the constraints, you got your organism, which is the, you know, do they have the right mobility, do they have the good enough strength or speed? That stuff, we're already taking care of that stuff. Then you have like the task constraint, you know, what's the starting position, can I use my arms in this drill, can I, you know, like, who knows? And what's the environment like? How many opponents do I have to go against in this drill? What's the terrain like? If you wanted to throw that in, if you're an actual football coach and you know you're going to be playing in the rain or something like that, do you prep them in the rain? You know, you probably should, because that's a constraint. So, and really the whole thing with that stuff that Sean preaches is the whole repetition without repetition, that Nikolai Bernstein, like, ideology and concept of every single rep when you're doing this type of training should be different from the last one. So if you have two guys reacting to each other, it'll always be different because they're not going to react the same way each time. But even if you're doing a closed drill, like if you have a cone drill or something and you want to run to this cone and that cone and then that cone or whatever, change the position of the cones on the next rep. You know, it's just like always change something. And that's how guys are going to be able to take ownership of their movement and really like their global movement, where now it's not just sprinting in a straight line. Now it's combining all of these different elements. And the one book that I absolutely love is Game Speed by Ian Jeffries, where he sort of helps to categorize all this stuff. He's got like transitional movements. He's got your initiation movements, your actualization movements, which is basically just sprinting. Like once you know where you're going, you're just going to go full speed to get there. But he classifies it really well in that book, and that really opened my mind up to all this stuff as well. So yeah, I think it's really important, man, because it's a whole, there's a whole component to physical preparation that is sensory motor in nature, and it's all dependent upon what are you doing in your sport. And if it's a team sport, there's a lot more just environmental complexity involved than a sport like track and field, where it's really just based on running your own race, you know? So I think it's important.
Yeah, absolutely, man. That was a great answer. What you said about halfway through there, it reminded me of something that Mark Watts had said on the podcast, and it was strength and conditioning coaches, we have to validate ourselves, you know, so what we do some way. And a lot of, you know, traditionally that's been through, well, I got my athletes stronger, I got their 1 minute max up, you know, or I got their 10-yard dash, I got their vertical up, so you know, I did my job. But right. At the yeah. same time, it's like, well, and through the more guests I've had, it's like, well, what really matters? And I think that what you're talking about there is something that really matters, is the driven by the context. I think that's so cool. I like that stuff too. I think back when I was a basketball player in high school, and my coach had always said how he was like, oh, that was like one of the fastest guys or the fastest guy on the team. And when I would do acceleration drills in college, we would do these circuits where you'd be in the push-up position, and then the coach would clap, and you'd go for 20, or you'd be on your back and roll over. And I was the king of that stuff. I mean, but then we would get out the sensor, and I'd run 30 against all my teammates who I'd just beat in these reaction drills, and I got smoked, man. Like, I was the guy who could not – I mean, when it actually came down to it, I wasn't that fast, but I was just really good at reacting and things. And so maybe I – and I love those I love it that you brought up the variation of just having a person to chase. Yeah, it's like the anvil bringing the hammer back, or the blacksmith bringing the hammer back to the anvil, and it always comes back a little different way every time. And
right.
That's such a cool thing that you brought up there.
I think the coolest example I saw by Sean Mishka was the concept of writing your name. He's like, write your name on a piece of paper in printed font, and then try to do it again the same exact way. You can't do it. So it's like, you know, there, no matter what, from movement to movement, there's always going to be variation. And then he talks about try to do it in cursive now. It gets more complex. So like the more complex the task, the harder it is to master. It doesn't mean it's not trainable. It just means you got to take the time to actually do it. So I think, you know, I'm right there with you where it's just, is the guy getting by in his sport because he's so grossly fast and sucks at reactive stuff, but he's just so fast he can make up for it? Or is he kind of slow, but he's so good at reacting that he makes up for not having enough speed, you know? So my concept when I'm training my athletes is like, I want to get them better at both. So let me get their actual speed up. Let me get the measurable stuff as high as we can get it, but then also consider that now we have to apply it to the concept of the sport. And that's the great thing about having an off season. You have different phases to tackle all this stuff, you know? So I try to do it all. That's kind of my mindset.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'll have to check into that book. What was that book that you had mentioned? Game Speed, was it?
Yeah, Game Speed by Ian Jeffries. It's a great starting point for that type of concept of understanding how there's a multi-directional and just everything component movement wise to team sports, and I thought it's a great starting point for anyone that's looking into that type of stuff.
That's awesome. I love it. Okay, so talking about game speed and those things, I have to ask you, because I know you've posted about this on Twitter and things, but thoughts on, and obviously it's easy to, I mean, a fun thing to talk about, but thoughts on the speed ladder, and is there anything that it can apply for, and why, you know, are we obsessed with it and all this stuff, as a, you know, people seem to get obsessed with it, but what are your thoughts on, is it good for anything, and what is it, how does it affect movement?
There, I'll start by saying that there is, in my opinion, there are positive components to it. And before everybody comes with their pitchforks and burns me down, let me make sure I state what those are. So I think it can be good to use if you want to use it in a warm-up. I think it's something that you can use with kids just to switch things up and make it kind of fun and interesting, where, you know, it's kind of like playing hopscotch in a way. It's just like different patterns of these little hopping drills or whatever. If you want to do it and take your shoes off, you can use it as a form of preparing the ankles and just kind of strengthening those up for different types of hopping patterns and stuff like that. I think it could be a great tool for extensive jump work or extensive step work and things like that. But where everybody seems to think it works, where it absolutely does not, is improving either true speed, and I mean, you know, straight linear sprinting speed or whatever, or improving your quote unquote game speed or your quote unquote footwork, right? So that's the stuff that drives me nuts, because they think that they're getting faster by using this tool. But if you take the concept of like their bodies in space and time, to get from point A to point B, if you want to get from point A to point B the fastest, what are you going to do? You're going to sprint there. You're not going to do all this footwork stuff, zigzagging back and forth and then going and then trying to get from point A to point B like that. No, like in the context of the sport, you know, and I deal with a lot of football players. That's why I'm using a lot of them as analogies in this podcast, because we primarily work with American football players. But if a wide receiver catches a football and he turns around and nobody's there, but the end zone is there, he's going to run straight to the end zone, you know? And if he turns around, there's a guy there trying to tackle him, he might cut one way and then maybe another way. So maybe two changes of direction, and then he's trying to run straight because they know they have to get to the end zone. They don't have to show off how fast they can move their feet. They need to show how fast they can get into the end zone. So, yeah, that's the stuff that sort of drives me nuts with that stuff, is how guys think that they're. What they really don't understand is like the physics component of it. Like there's like virtually no speed and hardly any power and like no force really when you're doing those drills. But when you're running full speed in a game and you got to stop on a dime, cut around somebody, huge amount of forces and power and speed involved with that, and eccentric stress or whatever you want to think of it as. It's completely different. And that's the stuff that they seem to misunderstand. So for me, I'm definitely part of the brigade that's trying to educate people against only using them all the time and understanding their place in the preparation, which is exactly what I said before. Use it as a warm-up tool. Use it as a way to help strengthen the ankles or do some extensive jump work on there if you want to make it like aerobic in nature. But don't consider it a tool that's actually helping your cutting ability or your speed or whatever. And another thing I find with it, a lot of guys that have come to us after doing almost exclusively ladder work, is they're super immobile. Because if you look at the positions on the ladder, they're almost standing straight up, and they're just moving from like the bottom of the ankle down, and they're basically almost in like a semi-isometric state where they're just contracted everywhere. It's like they look like they just got electrocuted. Like everything is, their fingers are spread, like their neck veins are popping out. They're not relaxed, you know, because they're trying to like, how fast can I move my feet? You know, so they're creating this irradiation all over their body. You know, if you study mobility, if you're in that state of isometric sort of irradiation and constantly contracted in a position, you're going to stabilize in that position. So now they're losing out on developing range of motion for things like sprinting or actually cutting, which requires a lot of dropping the hips and exploding laterally or whatever. You know, they're missing out on all that because they're wasting their time doing all this other stuff instead, when they should be really just training the way they need to be training.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
That's awesome. I like two things there that I think are really cool. And first, I wish that somebody would do a thesis or a research project on forces with a force plate on like actual cuts and actual sport movements versus what the forces are like when you just do a little tippy tap on the speed ladder and how minuscule those forces are in comparison. I think that would be awesome. It'd be like trying to train for a vertical jump by practicing a 10-inch jump when you're trying to jump 40 or something like that. But what you said there at the end, I had never heard that before. I think that's awesome. It's like It's almost like what I had heard Nick Winkelmann mention with co-contractions, like when you consciously think about something too much, there's too many external cues, like it causes, or internal cues, it causes more co-contractions in the muscle, like, because you have to be ready for kind of, there's just, you lose the fluidity. And now that I, after yep. hearing you say that, it totally makes sense. And yeah, it would probably lead to more rigid agility, if anything else, not fluid movement. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely not fluid at all. And, you know, not to name names, but we got a guy right now with our guys that he exclusively only did that type of stuff. And, I mean, can't even do a bodyweight squat. But all that aside, he's significantly slower on the sprint times. Even the pro day, like 20-yard shuttle and stuff, which you think that would be like his realm because he's this change of direction, like amazing athlete with change of direction. Slowest one on that. Slowest one on the three cone drill, which is another change of direction drill. I mean, it's like there's no going around it. You know, it's just like it's sort of that sort of the concept of how guys are great in spite of some of their preparation. So the guys see these pro guys that are doing all these ladder drills, but they don't see they don't pay attention. They pay attention to that, but they don't pay attention to the fact that those same athletes are probably running routes or they're actually doing their sport movements as well. Like they're not just doing the ladder. Yeah. It's not like a magic tool that if you just do that, you're going to be great. Like, you know, they do it and they post videos of it. So kids think that that's all they're doing, but they don't see the fact that they're doing all this other stuff too. And I think that needs to get out there.
Yeah. That's a huge important point. I mean, those guys could take away the speed ladder and just sit in a lawn chair and sip lemonade and probably get the same result. And then, you know, if they had if they showed the video of them sipping lemonade, people would be like, well, why are they showing this?
It's I need to drink some lemonade. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's why they're good. Yeah. Probably another topic, but an important one. Cool. Well, hey, so last couple questions on speed, and maybe I'm going to bring it back into maybe a little bit more the linear, like tracky type speed world. What are your thoughts on common errors in acceleration, and what are you looking to fix in the players that you're working with?
So I'm big on doing my best to help guys self-organize, right? Like I don't want to give so many cues that they're never going to get better and they just stay the same. So I try to put them in situations, and you know, I've seen everybody talks about this, like putting guys in a situation where you basically don't have to give them a cue and they sort of figure it out for themselves. So three of the biggest ones I've seen with, especially with football players and team sport athletes is number one is the arm action and the direction of the arms and where they're going. A lot of team sport athletes have sort of this side to side motion with their arms when they're doing linear sprinting, and they don't understand that if you look in slow motion at a sprint, the arms will always precede the leg. So in essence, they're almost kind of helping to guide where the leg goes. So if you're telling your leg to go side to side with your arms, then you're going to be, your pelvis is going to be rotating all over the place, your torso kind of doing this rotational movement as well. It's real sloppy. So that's the first thing, is I try to get them to understand that, like, you need to have your arms going in a forward and backward linear path if you're going in a linear direction, you know? So I focus on that. And that's one thing. Another thing is what I've seen Stu McMillan talk about from Altus is the concept of the guys that are trying to stay low for too long instead of naturally letting themselves come up to what is right for their anthropometry and the way that they're sort of built and how their bodies are designed and what works for their current abilities in the sprint motion. You know, he talked about how these guys that stay low for too long, they start overstriking, they start putting too much stress into the hamstrings, they're in this awkward position where they are putting themselves really at risk instead of just naturally letting themselves kind of come up as their acceleration ensues. So I think that's a huge one, especially with football guys when they're doing linear sprinting, is they, you know, they've been told since they were peewee football players that low man wins. So they think low man wins is that they have to stick their head and point it straight down towards the ground. Like they don't understand, like they're in this kyphotic and like rounded over like position when they're trying to sprint, they don't understand the concept of posture. So that's another one as well. And I think the last one is really just propelling themselves forward, is they have trouble with that. Like using their hip extensors to propel themselves forward in a linear path. You know, a lot of these ladder based type of guys, you see them pretty much just doing like a lot of steps, but they're not getting anywhere with each step. You know, my boss Joe DeFranco says getting nowhere fast. And they're moving their feet super fast, but they're not propelling themselves forward. They're not using their hip extensors to actually gain any kind of ground or any kind of stride length. So what I've noticed, to be honest, is that all three of those problems can be solved with using sleds and resisted running, because really quick, the guys realize that, and the 1080 has been great for that, but even just using regular sled sprints, because, you know, there's times where I'll have high school kids out there and I don't want to have to drag the 1080 all the way out there. So I think I'll just take a sled out there real quick and I'll use them on there. And, you know, the same thing applies where if they feel that resistance, now they have feedback and they have something that is giving them a different signal and basically telling them to self-organize in a different way. And really quick, you start to notice that guys realize that if they don't use a big enough arm action and if they don't go linear with their arm path, they're not going to get anywhere. If they're not propelling with their hip extensors, they're not going to get anywhere. And then, you know, the lean thing is more for unloaded sprinting. But I like starting with those other two issues by attacking with the resisted running and then mixing that in with some unloaded runs as well. So you get sort of that coordination when you don't have resistance. And just seeing how it improves by itself without actually really having to say too much. But I do try to at least explain the goal of what they're trying to do. And then when I put the resistance on them, that's sort of when it's like, okay, now do you feel what I'm telling you? Like, you understand what I'm saying? Like, if you don't use your arms a certain way, you're not going to get anywhere fast. If you don't actually like put force into the ground and push back to propel yourself forward, you're not going to get anywhere. Like, you feel it now, right? And usually, you know, they're like, yeah, I feel it now. And then with the body rise thing, like gradually coming up smoothly, it's sometimes just as simple as just telling them that that's what they need to do. You know, I think a lot of times I've had some athletes that say to me, what drill do I need? Like, I'll say to a guy, this is kind of getting a little bit away from linear, just to name an example, but I'll say to a guy, like, say he's running a route in football and I say to him, you want to drop your hips when you change direction. They're like, okay, what drill can I use to work on that? I'm like, no, like, just do it. Like, just drop your hips. Like, it's like, what do you mean? And I think that's the same thing with this natural rise. You just tell them, like, don't force the lean, like, just kind of let your body do what it does. And as you get, you know, stronger in the sprinting motion, maybe you'll keep a lean for a little bit longer. You know, just do what feels natural to you. And everybody's going to be a little bit different depending on how they're built. And as long as you're monitoring their outputs and you're taking split times, or, you know, with the 1080, you can see the force and the power and the velocity and all that stuff, which is amazing. As long as you're monitoring all that stuff, you can see if their outputs are the same or not. And it's funny because out of all my football guys that are training for their pro days, the guy who's like by far the fastest out of all of them, he rises up relatively quick and he's pretty upright, you know, pretty much right at, like, when he does an unloaded 40 yard dash, like right at between 15 and 20 yards, he's already pretty much upright and he takes off. And he's by far the fastest out of everybody with the sprinted runs, the unloaded runs and all that stuff. And the guys that are trying to lean too much, you see, they kick out the back, you know, they do that butt kick type of motion. And then they're talking about like, hey man, I don't know if my hamstrings are strong enough because they're feeling a lot of pump right now. And then, so the other thing I've done to help with that stuff is filming them. And I say, this is what, look at what this guy's doing where he doesn't have any hamstring problems. And look how he looks when he's doing it. Now look at you. Like, you're doing this butt kick thing instead of just, you know, having more of a cyclical, like, bicycle pedaling type pattern to your run. And I think just getting them to visually see themselves really helps. But then also having sort of that feedback mechanism by putting a little bit of resistance on them really helps with just me saying not too much, where I don't have to say too much where they're going to be confused and not understand what to do. It's enough to just get them to do it. And I think that, you know, even just doing like a hill sprint, you know, sprinting up a hill is the same idea. So if you don't have access to a sled, you have access to a hill, you know, something like that. And that's stuff that guys have talked about forever, but a lot of those issues can be fixed by doing that, because you know you're running up a hill, you need to propel yourself up the hill. And yeah, I think that the more I can just find ways to put them in positions where they don't have to think so much and it just happens, and then they feel that, then that to me is like, okay, that's a victory for me, you know, and a victory for them.
Yeah, totally, man. It is really simple, isn't it? Like before, you know, the world of motor learning and external and internal cues and all this stuff, they just have people run up a hill or drag so they get. I've always been interested by some of the technical things that just dragging a sled could do. And
oh yeah.
I like what you had mentioned about the that transition phase, because yeah, that seems like a lot of track coaches will all have these different opinions on what should happen from early acceleration to top end speed. And I even think of like Flojo running, you know, she was running 10:49 back in the day, and she was up at like 15 or 20, like straight up almost 15 or 20. And then you got all these people like these Jamaicans who are, yeah, like Stu McMillan had mentioned, like who are down for so long. And
yeah.
And yeah, it's kind of what you said, like it very largely is depending on the abilities of the athletes and what they can do.
Yeah, I mean, if they can stay low for that long and they got the hamstrings to do it, then you know, more power to them. And if that's their style, and you know, as Sean Mishka says, the movement signature that's right for them, then by all means. But you know, I think it's just about helping the athlete find their identity with this type of stuff, and making sure that it's just efficient and as low risk as you can get. Because people tend to forget that if you're in an upright position, you can still accelerate. I think people think like once you're upright, it's over. Like you're going to start decelerating and it's done. Like you can still accelerate. Yeah. You know, it's just finding that groove and training for it. So
yeah,
I think that's what people tend to forget.
Yeah, and not to I didn't say with the Jamaicans, I guess, to say that it's good to stay in the dry phase for so long. But yeah, maybe there was someone who could handle. Like I think Mo Green did it for a long time, and maybe his body could handle that doing well, and everyone decided to copy him. I don't know. But yeah, good thoughts there. I'd like to turn it to a couple questions on jumping, and then
sure.
So, first one is, what are some of your special strength movements for jumping, or what are some things that you do to improve jumping from maybe a weight room or special perspective, such as jumping Bulgarian split squats or other things?
Oh man, so yeah, like the list of the stuff that I try to use when it comes to jumping is like, so I literally have like an Excel template of like just so many exercises that I try to pull from. So my big thing with that is a huge variation component. You know, I like doing every type of jump that I possibly can with these guys. I do like to progress as the off season goes on. I like to do sort of a progression almost in everything from like force dominant to speed dominant as the season gets closer and things like that. So I do like starting with jumps that are more long coupling and then progressing to shorter coupling jumps and, you know, longer ground contacts initially, shorter ground contacts as we go forward. I like mixing in double leg jumps with single leg jumps. I love doing resisted jumps where it seems fit, doing resisted single leg jumps, doing obviously unloaded jumps. I've recently contemplated trying to start doing a little bit of assisted jumps after, you know, listening to JB talk about it a little bit, and then doing linear jumps, multi-directional jumps. I mean, jumps into throws, jumps into sprints, like the more variation, the better in my opinion. And, I know Joe DeFranco and I are both, we like just kind of playing with the contrast type of stuff as well. Where, you know, mixing some lifting exercises with some unloaded jumps or loaded jumps with unloaded jumps, things like that. And to us, it's about variation. You know, what type of stuff can we do? And I think a huge one that people really ignore, and especially for team sport athletes, where, well, more than just team sport athletes, but with team sport athletes, how much is really done on one leg in the game, you know, like cutting motions and things like that. So I like using a lot of single leg variations. And it's actually hilarious to watch guys try to do it because nobody, typically, like not a lot of people really use it. They think, you know, double leg jumps because those are going to get you higher and they're faster ground contacts and stuff. But the single leg jumps from just a coordination standpoint is like, it's so funny to watch like pro athletes try to do some of the single leg work because they're just like, they're like so awkward with it at first. Like just try to get them to do like a, a submaximal, like single leg broad jump, like take off on one leg, land on two. Just them standing on one foot is already awkward, you know? Or doing like a single leg box jump or something like that, and single leg, you know, mini hurdle hops or something. Like that stuff is always hilarious to me, but I think it does a lot for them to mix that in there. But I always like doing a combination of bilateral and unilateral jumps in the same session. And that way they kind of get from both sides, and they sort of keep the, I guess, the motor control, if you want to say that. They keep that at its highest because they're getting exposure to all these different things, and it keeps them honest, and they start to find the similarities, you know, the attractors, if you will, between the different motions and whether or not they have load on them or not. And I believe that there is some good transfer to a lot of different athletic movements because they now have all this different coordination that they've built up by doing single leg, double leg, weighted, unweighted, linear, multi-directional, like all these different stuff. So I just like getting creative with all of it.
Cool. It's almost more game-like in nature, where obviously you're not gonna the whole game. You're not gonna do a standing vertical. You're gonna do the possibilities are almost endless with how many different types of force applications on one leg or another you're actually gonna do.
Yeah, and with all that stuff, I still like to measure all of it. So I have, you know, I keep records of all of it. So if we do a single leg vertical jump, I have the right leg versus the left leg, the performance that they did on that. And then, you know, a single leg broad jump into a double leg broad jump might be a variation. I have a record of that. So I have like a huge library of stuff that I keep records on all this stuff. But I want to know if I ever bring it back. Like, hey, last time you did a single leg broad jump into a double leg broad jump, you know, kind of continuously, you jumped this far. So try to beat that this time around. You know, I just like kind of cycling things in and out and still giving them variations, trying to keep records on all of it. And it's pretty cool to see sometimes like what they can do on one leg. You know, like we had a guy, you know, people think like a 10 foot broad jump on 2 feet is pretty good. And he did like eight and a half on 1 foot, you know, just like pretty close to 10 feet. Relatively speaking, it's just like stuff like that that people don't even think about. It's like, well, what can he, if he can do this on two legs, what can he do on one? And just trying to see what the deficit might be. And it's also interesting to see from left to right how different that might be. Most guys are pretty balanced, but like I think like 2 days ago, I had a high school kid that had just come off some foot surgery a couple months back, and I did a single leg. I did like a step up jump for height. And he jumped probably 6 inches higher on his right foot versus left foot. It was nuts. So like, there's clearly an imbalance there. That's a risk, you know? So, just keeping track of all that stuff too.
That's cool. So, how does the step up jump for height work? Do you jump up to a vertec and touch it like off of it with one leg on a block, or you use a jump mat somehow?
I use a jump mat for everything because the facility that we have, we don't have a vertec, and B, the ceiling probably wouldn't allow us to have a vertec, for some of the guys that are a little taller. So, what I do is I have a just jump mat, so it's nothing fancy. It's like the most basic jump mat, and I'll get creative with it. So I'll put it on top of a box, and I just have them jump because it still picks up the number, you know. So, and it is pretty consistent between guys and what you're visually seeing. You know, it'll look like a guy jumps about a foot off the thing, and it'll pick up around 12, 13 inches on the thing. So, it's definitely, you know, I don't know how scientific it is or whatever, but it's enough to get a number out of what we're doing with all these different variations. And you know, the jump mat's great because I can take heights when they're, you know, holding weight in their hands, if they have a barbell on their back as well. And yeah, like with the step up jump, just put it on top of a box and just put 1 foot on the mat, jump as high as they can. I tell them to keep their legs straight after it leaves the mat, so they're not tucking their knee too high. Cheat the measurement, and then they just land back on the mat, and it gives me a height, and I record it. So that's what I do.
Oh, that's awesome. I love it. That like is stirring up all these ideas with me over here. Because it's almost like I've started to realize, I mean, shoot, man, you're 26 and you're doing all this stuff. I think that's awesome. Like I'm 33 and I'm just starting to kind of look at, okay, if I'm not, all these other ways to do a vertical, I could like do a standing triple jump and then touch the vertec at the end of it, and or do there's the possibilities are endless, but it's so much fun, especially when you've just been doing like training for a standing vertical or just doing a regular double leg depth jump for so long, it gets old. And then there might be a day too where you're kind of down, like you maybe are not feeling like your best, and maybe this is the bigger, faster, stronger mentality, but you can PR in something. You can PR in something.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep. I love that idea, because there's been so many times where maybe we're on the field and we're doing sprint work and guys are like not so great. Like they're staying, you know, around their PR, but they're not hitting PRs or they're not feeling too great. And then we go back and maybe we do a jump exercise after, and then they hit a PR in the jump. You know, it's like, you never know what's going to happen from day to day. And, you know, that's exactly what I tell them. I'm like, you know, we're taking measurements on everything, even down to like a bicep curl. So just try to win somewhere each day. Even if you get a little deeper in your squat when you're doing your bodyweight squat in the warm up, like just win somehow, you know, like just find a victory in the day. Cause that's so important psychologically that they're at least seeing some kind of progress. And I think that's the importance of keeping measurements on everything too. It's just telling them like, hey, you know, your sprints sucked today, your jumps sucked and your lifting sucked, but hey, in your dumbbell Bulgarian split squat today, you got maybe 10 pounds higher than you did last week. That's pretty good. You know?
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that, man. I've had some athletes, especially swimmers, who are like, have this mindset that I must lift more than last week at all costs. Like, and
it's impossible.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And the ability to give them something to say, hey, this, you did this better. Like, this was better. I think that's so cool.
Oh yeah, no question.
You're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, brought to you by Simply Faster.
All right, awesome, man. So a couple more quick questions for you before the end of this podcast. And the first one is, what's your take on training the feet for sport? I know I've heard Joe DeFranco talk about the flexor hallucis longus and big toe, and I've actually in one of the muscle testing courses I've taken, neurokinetic therapy, there's the big toe test, and I find it interesting to do the strength test on that. But what's your take on training the feet for sport or things like agility, speed, and jumping?
I think it's huge. I think it's something that especially, well, with everybody, but especially now with the new age of high school kids and junior high kids, is just, it's amazing how like terribly weak they are from the ankle down, and just how they have no ability there. And obviously, you know, everybody blames the footwork, and rightfully so, or the footwear, not footwork. let me never use that word. So they should blame the footwear, because they got these kids coming in with their high top Jordans or, you know, whatever their new, you know, LeBrons or whatever, like these kids are wearing these shoes that their foot never moves, you know, like they're basically walking on blocks. And it's so funny, because every time we do our warmups, we always do the warmups with no shoes. You know, we get them out of the shoes for the warmup. And you watch kids that have never gotten out of their shoes and try to do this stuff, and like watching them just squat or even lunge, because they start toppling left and right when they're trying to do lunges. I mean, like no stability from the ankle down. And the other thing we do is when we do our main lifting for lower body. So if we're doing like a squat, say a squat deadlift or a lunge or whatever it is for the lower body, we get them out of the shoes for that too. Because especially with the single leg work, when we go heavy, like, well, I'm big on incorporating some single leg work into the primary exercise as well, instead of only squatting and deadlifting all the time. But just watching how their feet are kind of working when they're doing that stuff, I think it goes a long way. And then I also like doing it when we do any kind of sort of extensive jump work as well, which I like to incorporate that stuff into my warmups. I like doing a lot of extensive jump stuff in the prep before we even start the workout. And like I said, in the warmups, we're always out of the shoes, you know? So just little things like that I try to do. I don't do things like, you know, some guys are doing calf raises or just like whatever. I don't do a lot of that stuff. I just like getting them out of their shoes, because now they're performing these more, you know, multi-joint movements and stuff without shoes, and the ankle is included in that multi-joint name. So, but definitely with the lower body lifting, and then like the auxiliary lifting as well, like they're out of their shoes the whole time. Obviously I tell them to keep their shoes on when we're doing jumps and sprints and stuff like that. But I also look at the footwear they're wearing, and I try to tell them to get some different stuff if they need it. You know, I don't want them doing sprint work in these high top shoes and stuff. And I tell all of them to look at, you know, trying to get track shoes without spikes, you know, like if they can, or if we're on the turf field, then just wearing like some flexible cleats or something that are made for football players and stuff like that. But I love those, like just those cross country type shoes, you know, that are super flexible and you can sprint in them, you can jump, you can lift, like you can do whatever you want in those. I think those are great for going to workouts in. And that's usually, I work out in a lot of stuff like that. But yeah, especially here in like, I think it was JB on your podcast when you guys were talking about the importance of the ankle and keeping it strong. And, you know, just hearing how it just made so much sense the way he said it, because you have to transfer, you know, the force you're generating at the hip all the way through the ankle. So if your ankle can't, you know, withstand that force transmission, you're going to have a leak. And if you have an energy leak, you have an inefficiency. And at that point, now your force capacity goes down in the horizontal direction. And, you know, and it's vertical too, if you're doing jumps, you know, whatever it is, it's just, I think it's really important. I like to get guys out of their shoes as much as I can and just working with their feet as they were God given, you know? So,
Yeah, man. I think that's awesome. Yeah. The more, especially through doing the podcast and just talking and networking myself, it seems like the more like really good sprint coaches I talk to who get it, like the feet is always a big topic. And I agree with you. You see so many kids who are in these like super cushiony, like high heel drop shoes that just aren't doing anything for them. And I like what you said about the barefoot and the weight room on single leg. Cause yeah, if you watch someone single leg stance, you can tell so much just standing there. So in any exercise, it almost gives you an extra opportunity to kind of see how their feet are operating and their, you know, pronation and supination and those types of things. I like that a lot.
Oh yeah. If you see them try to bring their big toe up, like if their rear foot is planted on the ground, they have no range with that stuff. Like they just don't do it because of the shoes that they're wearing. And they all kind of say the same thing. They're like, oh man, my big toe is so tight. You know, it's like, well, there's an issue there. You know, like if there's no motion there, there's an issue. But I like doing the single leg work kind of heavy in the primary exercise, because then when their back foot is behind them, like say a reverse lunge, right? And they're taking their back foot back and they have to like press off that big toe to come back forward. Against high loads like that, it really helps to build up the strength. And it was sort of just a trial and error thing I tried doing. And I've really stuck with it because I feel a difference in myself when I do lifting like that. And all of the guys, you know, they don't complain about their ankles anymore, really. Unless it's their first time doing it, you know. But once they're in the program for a little while, they start feeling really good from the ankle down.
Yeah. So with that reverse lunge barefoot, you're saying the rear big toe has to flex, or
right?
Yeah, it has to flex more. It's like a mobility exercise all in one.
Yep, exactly. So now it's, you know, you're putting context into what you're doing, and instead of just taking, because time is limited with the athletes, you know. So as much as I would love to spend a lot of time doing like ankle mobility stuff and toe strengthening stuff, I know that if I can get them out of their shoes and do lunge patterns and stuff like that against, you know, higher resistances, then that's going to mobilize, it's going to strengthen, it's going to help them. And it might not be the most ideal way to do it, but it is going to help them out. It's going to.
Yeah, no doubt, man. That's awesome. Awesome stuff. Well, hey, Cameron, that's all the time I got for the podcast today, but loved your work and your answers there. And man, I'll tell you, for at age 26, you're doing some awesome stuff. So keep up the good work with all that. And I'm looking forward to seeing your results of the resisted heavier sprints with those guys down the road.
Well, thank you, man. I appreciate the kind words. And yeah, I'm keeping track of all that stuff. And I'd like to try to throw a little article together or something where I'm going to try to report, you know, the results of what's going on with that. So, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens with it over the next couple of weeks. And, you know, thanks so much for having me on, man. It was awesome. I love being here.
Awesome. It was great having you. Well, have a good one, man. We'll hopefully talk to you soon. All right, thanks for tuning in with us today for another episode. We really appreciate you guys listening. If you enjoyed it, please head on over to your iTunes or Stitcher subscription service and drop us a review. We'd really appreciate it. Also, please visit our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, suppliers of high-end speed and athletic performance training technology, including the 1080, which we talked about. So they have it there. If you're interested in it, Christopher just does an awesome job with answering questions, customer support, demonstrating the technology, and helping you get the best out of it. So head over to Simply Faster for an amazing sports technology experience. We'll see you guys on the show next week. Until then, have a good one.